Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
You're listening to The Dialogue with Diwa de Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. And you can text us on 2057 and email inbox@realitycheck.radio with any thoughts you might have during this interview. And we are joined now by Kaiden McCormick, who is a regular guest on this show. We've previously talked about Vladimir Putin and also about Haiti. So welcome back to the show, Kaiden.
Welcome, Diwa. It's good to be here.
And in some kind of roundabout way, I think we're going to put together a few of the things we've talked about previously, although there's going to be a brand new subject. We're going to be focusing on Africa today. And the pitch that you made to me for this discussion, which was going to be a round table at one point, but it's ended up being just the two of us. And the pitch was Ukrainian and Russian special forces in Africa. And I thought that's quite an intriguing situation going on over there in Africa. But before we focus on why these Russian and Ukrainian special forces might be in Africa and where they are, I thought we'd quickly touch base on Haiti, because we talked about it now several months ago, and we had a little look in the news just before on what's happened there. You theorized at the time that some African countries would actually go and be brought in to restore order. And it seems to sort of have been attempted. I see that the Kenyan police ended up in there, which I do believe was your prediction. But they've basically been a complete failure, and it's completely dropped out of the news, and the entire place is falling apart in the same way that it was back when we did the discussion about it.
Yeah, nothing ever changes, right? Now they've just announced they're in a state of emergency. And I mean, I don't see this changing anytime soon, to be honest. I just saw the other day that they're moving in thousands of Haitians into the States, into small towns, and culturally enriching them. So the solution seems to be, instead of fixing Haiti, you just bring the people from Haiti to the States.
Yes, I saw several towns there in the United States with, say, a population of 4,000 or something, and then having 2,000 Haitian refugees brought in. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was something like half the town's population suddenly turning up overnight. And that's going to be a big problem in the United States. And I see that Donald Trump is increasing his election rhetoric on this as well. Clearly not a good solution for them. But with Haiti being unfixable, and it being a former French colony, we've also got a whole bunch of former French colonies in Africa. And the focus today, hopefully, will be mostly on West Africa. What exactly is going on there in the Sahel region in Africa, where we know that Russian and Ukrainian special forces are operating?
Well, what's going on there is essentially a proxy war being fought between the West and Russia, whereby Russia is using Wagner as its sort of agent to flip or support some of these West African regimes that are turning their back on France. So the three that we'll focus on will be Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. So they're all landlocked countries in the West. And so it's in this area called the Sahel region. It's this 1,000-kilometer belt between the savannas to the south around Sudan, and then to the north is the Sahara Desert. And so it's this sort of semi-arid, it's not quite a wasteland, but it's not very easy to grow food. It's not very resource dense, or at least the resources haven't been exploited yet. And they're quite remote. So these three countries have just made up a recent alliance called the Alliance of Sahel States. Don't read out the acronym out loud, right? But
the ASS.
Yes, the ASS.
That's going to stick. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't think that through, did they? So these three states are relatively underdeveloped. They're, like a lot of other sub-Saharan Africa states, wildly corrupt, high crime rates, at least the crime that you can report. But also they've turned against the West and against the French, who sort of had them as dependencies for quite a while.
So this is an ongoing decolonization in Africa. I think we often talk about decolonization in Africa as happening in the past, but the French maintained a bit of a stronger grip, I think, on many of their colonies, especially in West Africa. And decolonization is continuing. They're being pushed out. And in that process of decolonization, several different factions are looking at stepping into that gap, some new new colonization, or sort of the, it doesn't end in terms of outside influence. So interesting to see Russia stepping into the gap there, and I suspect China will be involved in a small way as well. And as I understand it, they also have big problems with terrorism in that general region. So could you explain sort of the geopolitical situation there? Because the Arabs and the Muslims are quite populous in that area.
So it mostly goes back to early 2012 when Gaddafi gets toppled. He had been using these nomadic Berber peoples called the Tuareg. There's a few others in that region north of Mali. So Gaddafi is toppled, and all those weapons end up equipping these nomadic peoples. And they decide, well, we're going to establish our own state as separatists. And now that they're like heavily equipped, because beforehand there had always been, you know, an issue for the country of Mali. They'd always been, you know, attempting independence, let's say. But only now they've been equipped with like DSHK machine guns and, you know, technicals with rocket launchers on the back. So they've got pretty heavy ordnance now, and they managed to take a significant amount of northern Mali. And all the while, you have this uprising of Sunni Muslim, they are basically terrorist organizations. So you've got the Al-Qaeda branch of the Sahara. There's a particular acronym, but I mean, you can just think of them as Al-Qaeda. They've got the Islamic State, essentially, in this area a bit later on. And so they're causing a lot of chaos for Mali, and you know, the legitimate government of Mali is struggling. The French troops that are stationed there, okay, they go around killing a few jihadists, but they're not dealing with a major threat to these countries' legitimacy. And so this spreads from Mali into neighboring countries of Burkina Faso and Niger. And eventually, you know, you see this spread into Nigeria, Chad, and all these other West African states.
And the borders in these countries, I believe, were sort of drawn up by the French as well, in a large part to split up ethnic groups and kind of put power in the hands of the tribes that the French favored. And there seems to be quite a bit of kind of cross-border tribes that have, or ethnic groups that are placed across both sides of the borders in many of these countries. And so it's a potentially breakaway states or larger, I suspect a large part of this is ethnic conflict basically that goes back, like tribal warfare is what I'm trying to say. This tribal warfare that goes back centuries in many cases, right?
And it's impossible for them to even police these borders because they're so wide and the funding isn't there. The you know, organization certainly isn't there. So, you know, they do tend to get overrun. And as a result, there's, you know, all these atrocities and so on.
And you've had French troops there, perhaps the United Nations as well. How has that failed then in recent years since Russia's been able to step into this gap? The only way that Russia can step in is if Western countries are basically not bothering anymore.
Yeah, so essentially how France has operated the region so far is what someone, I guess, like Noam Chomsky, you know, one of these sort of left-wing, activist types, they call it a form of neocolonialism. So these West African countries, not all of them, but they generally held together in an economic union called ECOWAS. And ECOWAS stands for the Economic Community of West African States. And a lot of these countries use the West African franc. And this is essentially a currency that is backed by the French. You know, the French have this sort of relationship where 50% of the foreign reserves have to be held in the French banks of each of these, you know, countries. And that gives them a lot of sway over the way that they run their economies. But at the same time, the French aren't doing any form of nation building, right? They're not putting in the type of elites or, say, dictators, right? Because that's always what ends up happening, who want to build up the capital base of their countries. You're not getting a Park Chung-hee or a Lee Kuan Yew. You're getting someone who's, you know, just there to loot and pillage his own countrymen. So all the while, they're not even able to provide basic security for the civilian population there. And these African leaders in West Africa and the ASS and not happy with that.
And there must be a decrease then with French influence then in terms of pushing out the French franc, the franc as well, the currency, the banking reserves that are being held in France. They must be decoupling themselves from that as well, or
yeah, there's an attempt to by ECOWAS to reform the West African franc into its own currency, but that's still a work in progress at the moment. So, and who knows what will happen with these breakaway states?
And the exploitation of minerals is usually people who oppose colonization will complain: are they colonists? The Europeans, they came and they stripped these countries of resources, and that's why they're so poor. But we've seen a massive gold boom in West Africa recently, a whole bunch of other rare earth minerals as well, used for, say, building electric cars and so on that everybody likes to use. A lot of those minerals are still located in Africa. They haven't all been pillaged. And I think you referenced this earlier, basically saying there's not really a utilization of the resources. So the British tended to leave good infrastructure. It seems like the French didn't really bother to leave good infrastructure, but they are, as far as we can tell, there is a massive amount of wealth in each of these West African countries, and whoever can actually exploit it properly will end up being extremely wealthy, right? There's a potential for, say, the Gulf states kind of situation to emerge in West Africa if you have the right people who are making the money and actually trying to build something with it rather than just personal enrichment, looting the treasury as it's going on at the moment.
Yeah, so right now, yeah, there's this sort of gold rush happening. A lot of the gold mines in these states are, these countries are sort of, yeah, they're untapped. They have a term for it, like artisanal mining, which essentially means child labor to, like, it's a term that they use, like gold panning, right? Where you kind of collect a bunch of soil and then pan it out for gold. It's that sort of process, very unofficial, just mining on the surface level. They haven't had any access to Western equipment until quite recently, and so back in the 90s, Senegal started being exploited for gold and they found massive deposits. And this attracted a lot of workers from neighboring countries like Mali and started to industrialize a lot of these mines. And this idea that Senegal had these untapped gold deposits spread to Mali and these other countries. And so more recently, Wagner's been the private military company that we're about to talk about has been given access to a lot of these mines, essentially like running them entirely themselves to help fund their operation. But we don't even know how much they're being funded, like how much gold is being tapped at the moment, because it's really new territory for everyone.
So most people will know Wagner, the Russian private military company, from Bakhmut, which is a big battle in Ukraine last year that went on for months and months. Basically, it was called a meat grinder. Wagner were accused of using human wave tactics and throwing convicts and prisoners in, into this densely built up urban area in Bakhmut. And then they attempted a coup on Vladimir Putin. Their leader, Prigozhin, was stopped, or he surrendered, and he was sent over to Belarus, and then he was assassinated very shortly after that.
Well, we don't know that yet. His plane mysteriously blew up in midair. He tempted fate.
Yeah, that's right. It was a plane malfunction while he was traveling between Belarus and Russia, and he was in no way assassinated by Vladimir Putin. That's a completely...
Well, it's conjecture.
Far-fetched story, right? So... But what happened to Wagner after that then? Because I believe what was reported is that Wagner was basically, all of Wagner was in Ukraine. They were then pulled out, many of them placed in Belarus. So what is Wagner doing in Africa? Was there a prehistory to Wagner in terms of its operations in Africa then?
So I guess you can link Wagner all the way back to 2010, before they were even established, where the former founder of Executive Outcomes. So Executive Outcomes, just as a complete side note, was this the most influential private military company, I'd say, ever, because back in late 1989, and there was a South African, he was born in Rhodesia, but he's a SAFA, right? He founded this private military company to deal with a bunch of, I think, the communist insurgencies around Africa. And he was very effective. It was a very tightly run operation. And they ended up getting disestablished in 1998. But his influence lingered on. He was advising other African governments at how to deal with insurgencies. And you can praise him for his effectiveness at taking out someone like Joseph Kony. If you remember him back, 10, 15 years ago, he was using child soldiers. He was in the news for that. this guy who ran Executive Outcomes, his name is it's not coming to me at the moment, Ibn Barlow, right? He essentially advises African governments on how to deal with these insurgent threats. Anyway, so he meets up with a bunch of these Russian officials, and you know, they probably talk about, you know, how to start a PMC. And 4 years later, in 2014, that's when the war in Ukraine really starts, after the whole Euromaidan thing. Wagner essentially is the VPMC fighting that war on behalf of the Russian state. And they spread their operations out elsewhere into Syria. They provide assistance to Assad in taking out ISIS. And they end up running into conflict with American personnel on the ground. It's quite a wild sort of secret history in a way, what Wagner have been doing around the world. But a lot of their activities are centered in Africa. They're centered in South Sudan. They're centered in the Central African Republic, Madagascar. And the thing with Wagner is that they've got so many different shell companies and other sort of subsidiaries that are also private military. It's hard to determine what is Wagner and what is not.
So basically any PMC that you could trace back to Russia in some way is likely a Wagner operation.
Possibly, not necessarily. And so Wagner has been in the last, well, I'd say about last year, they've been slowly integrated into the Russian Ministry of Defense.
And the Ukrainians then, I mean, we mentioned them briefly in the pitch. I guess the Ukrainian special forces are sworn enemies of Wagner. Did they start to shift their or a little bit of focus into Africa very recently, or is there a history that goes back a bit further there?
Well, it's a very recent thing. Ukraine's been trying to get diplomatic inroads with some of these African countries, partly to sell grain to them. But, you know, just in general, it's good to keep diplomatic ties with everyone. But more recently, Ukrainian special forces have just been trying to fight Russia wherever they can be found. And Russia, as I alluded to before, you know, they've got a lot of gold mines and diamond mines, and you know, they run some of these timber mills across Africa. And so Ukrainian special forces are trying to disrupt these operations. And so just in July, Ukrainian special forces were supporting, they basically trained the Tuareg people into using drones, attack drones, and they managed to ambush and kill like 80 something Wagner guys in this like village in Mali, because of course, you know, like Wagner's propping up the government in Mali, as they are in Niger, as they are in Burkina Faso.
Right. I do remember seeing some of that. That's right. So it's quite a, maybe a strange story that many of the listeners wouldn't have heard, which is that you had, were they jihadis? So you had these Ukrainian-backed jihadis who ambushed a Russian convoy in the middle of Africa, like one of those kinds of stories, just completely.
I believe they were the Tuareg nomadic people, but it could have been jihadis. I mean,
well, I don't know enough, so I can't say.
I mean, yeah, I'm just relying on memory. I mean, the Tuareg are, half the time they're siding and fighting alongside jihadis, the other half they're fighting against them. So who knows?
Right. And so interesting now, so the Russians are now basically propping up all three of these countries in the Sahel were former French colonies, and all three of them are basically currently being propped up by Russia, strengthening their ties with Russia. And I was doing a little bit of reading on some of them, and it seems they're very heavily reliant on grain imports. So because, as you mentioned right at the beginning, basically a wasteland, all of these countries have no ability to grow their own food. And a big part of it is shipping in grain from either Ukraine or Russia. And that seems to be the key inroad for Russia. I saw the level of underdevelopment in those countries was so bad that Vladimir Putin promised one of them, and I can't remember which one, a grain shipment, and they sent the grain to the nearest port, and then it had to sit there, and they couldn't bring it into the country because the country itself didn't have the ability to even mill grain, had no ability to actually take the grain and turn it into bread. Now, that's just how completely underdeveloped and desolate many of these countries are.
Yeah, and like, you know, I think Mali, 70% of the population is below the poverty line. It's really quite dire in that country.
And in terms of what Wagner is doing there, are they behaving themselves? I suspect there are many UN investigations, US intelligence agencies are running, you know, trying to figure out what's going on exactly there. The Russians are known for being a little bit rougher, a little bit less interested in human rights than European countries might be. Are they actually improving these countries, or are they potentially causing a lot of damage?
It's difficult to say, because on one hand, you could make the case that stability is the only thing that matters. You know, if you've got a country that's falling apart and overrun by bandits and rebels, well, how many civilians are dying there? So I'm not justifying human rights abuses, but, like, you know, does a massacre or two really weigh up to, say, you know, bandits killing thousands of people per year, or like selling, you know, hundreds of schoolgirls to forced marriages? I mean, it's really quite difficult to tell. But I mean, the real difficulty of it, and even researching it, is the smoke and mirrors of it all. Can you trust the American State Department with what they're saying? Well, like, how much of that is propaganda? What about the United Nations? What about what the Russians are putting out? So there was this massacre that happened in Mali, this atrocity in the village of Moira. And, you know, like, the numbers of how many died vary by the hundreds. So essentially what happened is the Malian government entered this town using helicopters, you know, to secure it because they thought there were terrorists in the town. Well, turns out Al-Qaeda was in the town. They opened fire, killed a couple of Wagner dudes. And the Malian government and their Wagner detachment opened fire and killed a bunch of civilians. And, you know, they ended up cordoning off the town. There were mass reprisals. You know, anyone trying to escape the town was met with machine gun fire. And, you know, the Malian government comes out a week later and says, oh, well, you know, they congratulate themselves, pat themselves on the back, saying we killed 203 terrorists. Well, turns out a couple months later, the Human Rights Watch claimed 300 civilians dead. And then a year later, the United Nations Human Rights Report claims 500 dead. And then, you know, the Russian Foreign Ministry comes out and says, oh, this is all disinformation. So, like, who do you trust? Do you trust the Russians? I don't. Do you trust the UN? I don't. I mean, it's really hard to tell. I mean, we know one thing, that civilians would have been, you know, caught in the crossfire. So, yeah, Wagner. How much of that is Wagner? How much of that is the Malian government killing people? I mean, again, it's hard to tell.
That's right. How many of that's Al-Qaeda carrying out reprisals on people that they think are affiliated with the government and so on?
Mm. Yeah.
Now, the United Nations, then, did they not have a presence? You'd think this would be ripe for the United Nations to say, we have peacekeeping forces, we have security forces in these countries. Is there no real interest? Because I guess it's not reported in the news, right? If it's nobody in New Zealand knows about this, I didn't know about this until you pitched the idea to talk about it. Just nobody cares. So that's really the situation with the United Nations, then.
Well, the issue is that the United Nations, so the one in Mali is called MINUSMA, okay? So it's got this, you know, complicated sort of pretentious name. It's called the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Mali. And essentially that's a UN peacekeeping force. And, you know, you can read accounts of the way that they, you know, both by journalists. There was a book that came out by a Russian journalist on Wagner, and he interviews a lot of these Wagner personnel in these countries. And basically everyone agrees that they sit on, you know, they sit on their backside doing nothing. And the personnel of these United Nations missions come mostly from the third world, other countries like India, Pakistan, and they get paid handsomely for providing troops and, you know, peacekeeping operations. But a lot of the guys on the ground are quite corrupt. You know, there are reports going back to 2008 of them arming some of these rebel groups for gold. There's plenty of reports about human trafficking and rape, murder, extortion by United Nations peacekeepers. And again, this is all reports. It's not really, we don't know much about what's going on down there, but, you know, they're not very well liked by many of these African governments, because at best, they're doing nothing. At worst, they're like killing their own people.
And so that explains a little bit then why the government of Mali and some of the other Sahel Confederation governments prefer Wagner over the United Nations, basically. So it's not really Russia forcing itself in there. They've actually got the local government that's being propped up, sometimes then by both the United Nations and by Russia, is favoring private military contractors.
Yeah, so these African governments invite the Wagner into these countries essentially to stabilize them, because it's a form of building inroads. And with Russia, who they see as a trustworthy or friendly ally, I mean, during the Cold War, the Russians were giving arms and food and helping industrialize these countries, similar to the sort of the Marshall Plan that the Americans enacted in Europe, where, you know, they gave a lot of these countries foreign aid in the form of US dollars to sway them towards the West as opposed to the East. And so, yeah, the Russians during the Cold War did the same thing, except with giving, like, you know, free stuff to the Third World to turn them against the Americans. And so they've got a lot of these diplomatic ties still lingering. And so they tend to trust the Russians more because the Russians haven't really exploited them, let's say.
And with these, I guess we were just talking about like the potential for abuse and so on. There's probably less oversight with them using private military contractors like Wagner versus trying to get the UN to do something. You've got to go through all this paperwork, other oversight. You lose the plausible deniability they might have when they send Wagner in to do their dirty work and so on.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, the cost of direct intervention, you can just look at a country like Afghanistan and how the Americans handled that situation. I remember the former CEO of BlackRock, he was talking in an interview quite recently about how he proposed to Trump back in 2019 that he could hold Afghanistan with a, you know, small garrison of 4,000, 5,000 contractors. And then you just train up the local forces and you kind of, you know, push them into line. You don't need to have, you know, tens of thousands of American personnel. And I think the same thing would be true of Russia and China. Why do you need to operate through your national armies when you can just use a private military company with a tenth of the force? And of course, you get around a lot of the international law hurdles. Again, as you said, plausible deniability. If an atrocity happens, well, the atrocity is on Wagner, it's not, or the atrocity is on, you know, Blackwater, it's not on the American government, it's not on the Russian government.
And the history then in some of the, many of these African countries are basically communist countries, right? During the Cold War, the Europeans pulled out of Africa, decolonized. The British sort of gave up a lot of their colonies to communists. And did this help the Russians now, which, you know, Russia's no longer communist in any meaningful sense, but do they have these existing ties to some of these governments that they've been able to exploit and say the dictators that are, end up in power? Do they tend to have ties to former communist militias and so on that were roaming around Africa?
Well, it seems that way because a lot of these communist militias, a lot of them were trained in Moscow or trained in Russia. I mean, that's happening today. In fact, there's a lot of African officers being trained in Russian military academies. But yeah, going after like 1991, they would have kept a lot of ties with the Russian embassies. And again, because the French sort of their ability to conduct effective diplomacy declined because I guess it's, you know, they didn't care anymore. Their mission changed. The Russians just swooped in, you know, their liaisons can do a better job at sort of coddling these African leaders.
And is there some stability then in these governments, especially in the last few years, or do they have very frequent regime change in this part of West Africa? It seems like almost every other week that you'll see some coup in some country in Africa, and they very rarely maintain the same leadership for very long. Maybe they have an election, and then the military overthrows the elected government, and then some like rebel group will overthrow the military, and then it just goes around in circles over and over again.
I mean, you just have to go on the Wikipedia page and then, like, you know, type up coups in West Africa, and you have to scroll down several times just to like go through all the different coups since like 1958. You know, there's a coup left, right, and center. So yeah, I guess Wagner does provide stability, but despite that, there'll still be like military juntas. I mean, even when Wagner were backing some of the military juntas that took over these ASS states, there were additional military juntas trying to get rid of those generals, and most of those failed, but, you know, this stuff still happens. And I think the reason why is because the country is, you know, there's a book by Edward Luttwak that was written in the 60s, and it's sort of a half joke book called Coup d'etat. It goes through the various ways that you pull off a coup. And one of the things I think that's quite pertinent to Africa even today is that the communications in Africa are quite minimal. You know, so like the population's out of the loop. The population doesn't really have to be constantly told about the legitimacy of their government. One government goes, another comes. And so like, doesn't matter to the typical African, you know, who's working the street market, not really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're a tribal herdsman out in the desert, or you're working in one of these mines, child labor or whatever it might be, who the government is doesn't really matter, right? What matters is, do you have some food at the end of the day? Can you feed your children? That's the only question that they care about. And there seemed to be sort of this attempt then to force democracy onto them. We've seen this in many countries around the world, and especially recently in like Afghanistan and even Iraq. And the people don't really care about democracy. They care about putting food on the table. And so if there's a dictator, or as you mentioned, a coup, they don't really care. That's not what's going to drive them at the end of the day.
Well, that, and of course, they really only care if their tribal group is in power. And if it's not in power, then, you know, there's resentment builds up, and sometimes it can lead to, you know, atrocities like the Rwandan genocide. So it's, yeah, democracy is really a meaningless word, I'd say, over there. I mean, ECOWAS has tried to reinstate democracy in countries where there's been military juntas. Most recently, they did that in the Gambia in 2017 to, you know, restore democracy. And they still have 2,500 troops garrisoned there. So
democracy at the barrel of a gun.
Exactly.
Right. And it's because I talk about this on the show fairly often. It's a theme that comes into many of the interviews that I do and discussions that I have on the weekly roundup with William McGimpsey as well, is around basically, if you have a multi-ethnic, multiracial society or country, which many of these are, they're basically multi-ethnic, multiracial societies with borders that were drawn up by people who didn't care or who deliberately wanted to pit one tribal group against another. And they can never have a stable democracy because everything just comes down to it being an ethnic headcount. And yeah, there's the only real potential to have democratic stability then is to break those countries up along tribal lines. That doesn't really seem to be on the table either. I mean,
but even if that were to happen, it's like, do they even have the institutions required for democracy? I mean, look at how democracy came about in New Zealand or the Anglosphere in general. We've got, you know, 1,000 years of what is essentially common law precedent to build that up. You know, we've had parliament for how long? The African countries never have had that sort of thing. They've always been run by, you know, like sort of tribal monarchs. So it's always going to, unless they had those sort of institutions gradually build up, it's not going to be easy to put democracy in these countries.
And can you give us an example then of some of these coups that we've discussing, like how regularly do they happen? Really, I mean, as we said, like every other week, but can we be a little bit more specific than saying there's a few, you know, there's dozens and dozens of pages on Wikipedia, but in the last 5 years or so, have we had a handful of coups?
18 attempted coups.
Wow. Okay. That's in just the last 5 years, that's a lot more than I expected.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just those three countries. I mean, it's also, you know, countries like, you know, Sudan and, you know, the Democratic Republic of Congo more recently. So half the time they fail, half the time they succeed. It's sort of something you have to flip a coin for.
And then perhaps the most important question I've just thought of is how successful are they in actually getting rid of most of these Islamic terrorists, fighting Al-Qaeda or ISIS, whichever groups have formed themselves up there? Is there some progress that's now being made to decrease their numbers to actually provide stability? Or is there too much fog of war to make a determination like that?
There's probably too much fog of war. I mean, this was an explicit aim of the ASS, was to pull together their military assets to fight these insurgencies that affect all three of those countries. It was that, and of course, you know, to defy ECOWAS, who was threatening intervention in Niger last year. If you can remember that in the news, it looked like West Africa was about to go to war with all these countries about to go to war with one another. So they're pulling together their assets. It might be successful, it might not. You know, the issue is these countries are huge, these militants are constantly moving. Yeah, it's difficult to say.
And one of the other things that was in the news then was the, like you're saying, these countries nearly about to go to war with each other. This was around France as well. They were trying to re-establish their presence in, was it Niger? And they nearly had, was it, they had some influence in Nigeria, threatened to go to war with one of these countries over French influence. And nothing really came of it in the end, it seems like.
Yeah, that was over the coup. So the most recent coup was in 2023. When Niger, their military junta overthrew the quote-unquote democratic government. I mean, how democratic are they? I don't know. But, you know, this military junta overthrew them in July 2023. And so ECOWAS, I guess they were acting on behalf of the French with threatening intervention. And that ended up leading to the French being kicked out late last year, and more recently the Americans this year. Actually, the deadline for the Americans to leave Niger is next week. So they probably are ahead of schedule.
And does that leave just basically Russian influence in Niger and other West African countries? Do you see a lot of influence that China is trying to exert in that area, or perhaps any other players as well?
Well, I mean, I don't think China's really involved in West Africa at the moment. Most of their interest is in the Belt and Road Initiative, which is East Africa, South Africa, and exploiting the resources there. So maybe the Russians have developed a sphere of influence in a sort of backroom agreement with the Chinese. It's kind of hard to tell from the Western point of view.
And what's the overall leadership and stability of Wagner like after Prigozhin? Death and you know, after the role they played in Ukraine, does it look like it has a stable leadership and is going to carry on? You referenced
Wagner's been disestablished at the moment, so like you know, they're being integrated into the African cause,
right? So, when we talk about Wagner, they're really officially part of the Russian military. Then, is it not really a PMC, or is it still?
Wagner has been estimated about 5,000 men, down from, I think, like 45,000 last year. So they've massively shrunk, and that's because they've been assimilated into the African Corps, which is under the direct leadership of the Russian Ministry of Defense.
Right. So we are likely then to see the Russian military take a more formal presence then in West Africa. You'd see that as the likely trajectory of, you know, instead of plausible deniability, you actually actively see Russian military assets deployed in West African countries?
Well, it's hard to tell, because if you do that, then you're going to cast more attention. You're going to encourage the West to get more involved in West Africa and perhaps mount their own interventions. Of course, that's all depending on, you know, what government's in charge. So again, as we said before, plausible deniability and the ability to operate as a sort of semi non-state actor has its advantages when it comes to acting in these countries with impunity.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me to give us these insights into what's going on in West Africa. And it's been very interesting for me, and I hope the listeners have found it interesting as well, because there's basically nothing on the news about any of this. Sometimes some vague mentions of a massacre here and there. That's about it. And so if you've got any final thoughts you'd like to leave with us, and perhaps even, do you have some hope that things will get better in West Africa, or does it look kind of like Haiti, as we talked about several months ago, hopeless, and even for the next, say, in the next decade or two, are we going to actually see these countries develop and stabilize, or does that seem very, very unlikely to you?
It seems unlikely, and actually that's probably a good thing. You know, there's opportunities abound, right? This whole use of private military companies in Africa has kind of flown in the face of a United Nations directive. Back in 2001, a bunch of countries signed this agreement to outlaw mercenaries, and PMCs is an extension of that. And right now it looks like American PMCs, European PMCs, possibly Chinese PMCs at some point in the future, are all going to be involved in Africa. And so, again, opportunities abound, right? The United Nations looks like it's incompetent, and countries will take advantage of that and maybe throw off the yoke of globalism.
I was reading Bronze Age Mindset recently, and he mentions the son of Margaret Thatcher, I believe, who was involved with some of these PMCs and coups in Africa. He was unfortunately arrested with a connection of overthrowing some government in Africa. But it seems like that age of mercenaries is nowhere near over. That was sort of the 80s and the 90s, I think, when that was considered to be at its peak. And then it looks like the United Nations worked very hard to suppress it in the early 2000s. And we're basically back now to the soldiers of fortune. If there's anyone listening who wants to go out and make a name for himself.
Well, legally speaking, we're a signatory of that, so we can't actually encourage any of that behavior. We can't have any of those organizations in this country.
No, there are no New Zealand private military contractors. But it's a similar, I mean, we say the same thing when it comes to like Ukraine, right? There's officially no New Zealand involvement in Ukraine. But I saw recently the New Zealand flag being flown by mercenaries for Ukraine who are in, you know, participating in some of the operations, the incursions into Russia that they made themselves. So in all likelihood, there will be New Zealanders involved in one way or another in some of these activities. If not now, they would be down the line.
Yeah, it would seem so. I mean, what I understand with those New Zealanders in Ukraine, they would talk, you know, the New Zealand Defence Force basically said, what you do in your free time is up to you, right? So if you're on leave for 6 months and you want to go fight in Ukraine, well, you know, we've got no part in that.
Yeah, yeah. And officially, of course, they say, no, don't do that. You know, we strongly recommend you don't do that. But yeah, it's kind of...
I mean, what are you fighting for in Ukraine anyway?
Yeah. All right. Well, that's it for today. Once again, I appreciate the insights and to all of the listeners. That was Kaiden McCormick, who's joined us today, and he's a contributor on rightminds.nz, and he's been a good friend of mine for a while, and I enjoy your interest and research into these very, I don't want to say unique or obscure geopolitical situations, but they definitely ones that escape the news, they escape the discussion that most people have. And it's very fascinating to get your insights into what's going on there. And I'm sure that sometime in the near future, we'll have another Right Minds panel. We'll go to some other part of the world and we'll do something like this again.
Rightio, yeah, it's been a pleasure.
And to all of the listeners, please stick around. We will be right back after this break.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.